My sobriety date is 9/27 or 26. 26 or 27th, 1986. My sponsor and I could not, we tried to figure out, so we got close, because it was a couple weeks after I got sober that we were trying to pinpoint the day. And it was a Saturday. And I guess I was 27. I was over there trying to do the math. So I was 27. And now look at me up here coming up on 29 years speaking to you people. So how about that? Now, my story is going to be what it was like or what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And there is a vast difference that I think sometimes I take for granted. But there is a vast difference. I don't take it for granted too often, so I'll take that back. So anyway, I got sober 9/27 or 26, 1986. It was September. It was a Saturday. And I started drinking when I was really seven. My grandmother, who was a Polish immigrant, who made craft beer before it was cool, used to make her own beer. She used to give me a dollar to sip beer with her. Go figure, right? So I used to stash the dollars in my drawer, and my mother found them one day and made me give them back to Grandma. And my first thought at 7 years old, and I still remember, was it didn't matter. I didn't need the dollars in order to drink the beer with her. So, you know, it was just a bonus, right? Because I liked the taste of it from the get-go, and it was the Ballantine, I think, the three-ring beer. Was that Ballantine? It was the Ballantine, and I liked the taste of it from the get-go, so Grandma didn't have to pay me, but it was nice that she did. So that was my first taste of beer, and I remember thinking at the time that, boy, this tasted like something. I mean, this was more than just a tasty beverage. I kind of somehow knew that there was something about this that I wanted to partake of and that it was going to do more for me than just taste good. Somehow or another, I just innately knew that. It was an intuition or something. So I had two older sisters, and we lived in Pennsylvania at the time, right across the bridge from New Jersey, and they had lowered the drinking age in New Jersey to like 18. And my sisters used to drive across the bridge and get drunk and drink and bring the alcohol back. And I used to just sit and watch. And my first big drunk that I planned was to wait till they all got drunk, and I was going to steal a six-pack, and because I knew I would need at least that much. I was going to do it with my two friends, Lori and Sue. They were each going to get one, and I was going to get the rest. And turns out that's all they needed. So that was my first plan, and I intended, when I stole that beer, my intention was to get drunk. And I remember reading in the big book when it said, we drank to get drunk. I drank to get drunk. And I felt like, up until that period, I didn't fit in, I wasn't good enough, all the typical stuff. You know, I was always the oddball. And somehow or another, I knew that the alcohol was going to change that for me. And I got drunk that first time. I was 13. My mother had to come and scrape me up off the pavement down the corner because she did. And then Sue's mother drove up and scraped her up, and Lori's mother scraped her up. And we went home, and I remember laying in bed with the room spinning and thinking, this is crazy. Great. This is everything I thought it would be. And then some. And it was. And so I was off and running from there, and I was 13 years old. By the time I was 16, I was blacking out. And I knew then that there was something wrong with the way that I drank. I knew. I wasn't talking to anybody and telling them that I was blacking out. But I was blacking out, and I had a feeling that that was not normal. But that didn't matter to me, because I was off and running. I mean, this was my relief. I didn't feel those overwhelming feelings of self-loathing and inadequacy when I was drunk. So it didn't matter that I was blacking out and I was scared. And I'm telling you, from the time that I was 16, I was really scared about the road that I was on, but it didn't stop me. And I remember watching my grandmother drink and drink and drink herself to death. And I thought, as long as I get a job, as long as I have a job, and I don't drink in the morning, then I won't be an alcoholic. And so from that, I made that decision at that time, and from that time on, I made sure that all those things were in place, that I didn't drink in the morning, and that I always had a job. And I did always have a job, and I always moved up in my jobs. I always had jobs, great responsibility, and I always did well at them, and I always made good money, and I always had my own place, and I always had a car, and blah, 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 blah. So I couldn't be an alcoholic, because that was my criteria. Because an alcoholic was, you know, somebody who lived on the street, a drunk, couldn't hold a job, didn't have a car. So somehow I had it in my head that if you owned a car, you couldn't be an alcoholic. And actually, if you own a car, you probably shouldn't be an alcoholic. And that's part of my story, too. So, meantime, I was getting a lot of DUIs, and this was, in the 80s, and I was in Pennsylvania, and I had, 11 DUIs in 2 years. Now, you could do that then. You could, because they would put you in the car and they would drive you home. Because more likely than not, they knew who you were and they knew where you lived if you had that many DUIs. Or they would make you park the car and they'd take you home. Of course, you can't do that now. So that was God looking out for me. Well, my solution to the DUIs was to stop driving. Makes perfect sense, right? You got a problem with drinking and driving? Stop driving. So I did. And I moved to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where I didn't need a car. And I, do you know you can walk? You can have a WUI walking under the influence. I did a lot of that in Atlantic City. I woke up in a gutter one time, face down with the whole side of my face scraped in. I still to this day do not know what happened. But somehow or another, I managed to make it home in one piece from that. And I also rode my bike everywhere. And, yes, you can have a BUI, too. Biking under the influence. They don't give you tickets for that. But I was doing it. So that was my solution. As long as I wasn't driving and I was drinking, then I was okay. Because, remember, I had this criteria. And I wasn't going to be an alcoholic. So around 1984, it just went off. The same things, a lot of drinking, a lot of blacking out. I was in Atlantic City when the casinos were opening up, so I was running with a really rough crowd. And I controlled and I had a number of good jobs while I was in Atlantic City, too. And I kept it all together, and this was an important piece, by smoking weed in between. Because I made sure that my weekends didn't last too far past Monday. Because remember now, if you drink in the morning or you're drinking, you know, far into the week, then you're an alcoholic. And but the weed kept me even, kept the edge off, so I could get to the alcohol. Alcohol was my drug of choice. I liked it. It knocked me out. I felt silly. I felt in control, if that makes any sense. And it numbed me. And the weed kept the edge off till I could get to the alcohol. Because you can't hold down a job when you're drunk. But for some reason, I thought I was doing all right as long as I was smoking pot. But needless to say, that rocked on until I was about in my mid-20s, and the blackouts were, I did a geographic cure. My first was to Atlantic City, and then I did another geographic. I moved back home. I lasted about a year back home, and then I got a job offer to move down to Atlanta, and that was in 1985. Yeah, that was 1985. And, I mean, they asked me if I wanted to go, and I was at the end of a cycle with the drinking. I was at one of those places that I had been many times in my drinking where I thought, I need to do something. I need some help. Now, I had been there since I was 16 years old. And now here we are 10 years later, and I'm still. I never left that spot. I need some help. Something's not right. This isn't normal the way I drink. And I always thought that if I could just, somebody could just teach me how to have two drinks and then stop, I'd be all right. That was my problem. I liked beer too much. That was my problem. So I remember one time I did the great vodka experiment because I was strictly a beer drinker. And I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll drink vodka because I don't like vodka. And then I won't drink a lot and I'll stop sooner. You know when I stopped drinking vodka? When I fell out of my chair. When I fell off the bar stool. It sneaks up on you. So I went back. I went back to beer because I felt like that as long as I didn't touch the hard stuff that I was all right. So anyway, in 1985, a company I was working for, they were doing emissions inspections. They invited me down here to help them open up an office. And they didn't even have to pay me because I was looking for a way out. And I was sure, just like every alcoholic, the big book describes it so well, we're just so sure that this time it's all going to work. were just convinced. And so, and that's where I was when I moved down here in August of 1985. This is going to work. It'll be all new people. I have a new job. The boss really likes me. I won't drink and drive. And I had a car again after not having a car for about 10 years or so. So I moved down here in August of 1985 and was getting started with the business, helping my boss. Remember now, I've got a job, a car, and place of my own, so I'm not an alcoholic. Still blacking out, though. Drinking a lot at home. It was 1985, so now I'm drinking at home a lot. Big Book described me perfectly. So now I'm drinking alone and I'm drinking at home. And August 1985, I moved down here. September 1985, I came out of a blackout in Chamblee City Jail. Clank, that's what brought me out of it. And I had gotten into my car, I had this little Honda, and I had hit a fire hydrant right in front of the police station. I went back a week later. That is exactly where the fire hydrant was. It was like, you talk about having angels watching over you. It was like they said, please, guys, get her off the road. I don't even remember getting into the car. I don't even remember when I started drinking that night. I was at this apartment, and they had this thing called a crawl, where you go from one apartment to the next. I just remember the first apartment. I don't remember anything after that. So I don't even remember getting in the car. I don't even remember where I was going. And I came out of a blackout in the Chamblee City Jail. I don't know anybody but my boss. I've only been in town 3 months. I don't know anybody but my new boss. And I was crying, and the police officer gave me an Egg McMuffin. I'll never forget that. He said, Miss Bray, do you realize what you did? And I said, no, I have no idea. And he said, well, he said, you're here now, and you're going to have to call somebody and tell them to come get you. Well, I called my dad, which took a lot of guts, because I never went to my dad for anything. And he said, I can't help you. I'm in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And, you know, and I thought, okay. Well, somebody was watching over me, because I did call my new boss. I had no choice. I had nobody else to call. And I called him. And I said, please, and I explained to him what happened. And it turns out he was a really good enabler. And he bailed me out of jail, said, don't worry about it, honey. You don't have to pay me back. These things happen. It's okay. And I remember walking to the car with his arm around me and saying, but these things happen to me a lot. But he wasn't hearing me. It's not his fault. You know, he was where he was at, and I was where I was at, and, you know, it all worked out. Well, that scared me, that blackout. And so I went to talk to a neighbor of mine who was in CA, and he gave me the address for NABA, the NABA Club. And I called up, and they gave me directions, and I could not find it that night. I thought, I drove around in circles for a while, and I thought, I'll be all right. I said, I'll be okay. You know, this will be all right. So I went home. And I stayed dry for about 4 months after that. Well, I stayed dry all the way up till Christmas. And I smoked the weed, keep the edge off. And I stayed dry, and I did the DUI class that they send you to, which I thought that was it, because they gave me that little wheel. Did you ever do the DUI class? Which tells you how many ounces you can drink based on your weight and how long it... And I remember when they gave me that, I thought, this is what I needed all along. If I just had this wheel, and I would have known when to stop. You guys know that I thought that, because, yeah, I thought, this is it. Right here, I needed this little dial a drink. So I went to the DUI class, and I stayed dry. And Chris and I was smoking some weed, but I was isolating myself. I just went to work and went home. And Christmas Day, 1985, I'm home, I'm alone in Atlanta. And that was it. I was going to drink that day. So I knew there was a Happy Harry's or whatever they were called, Hungry Howie's or whatever, up on Chamblee Tucker in 85, because I'd seen him sell alcohol on Sundays, because they weren't doing that back then, or on holidays. So I went in there, and I bought a six-pack, and I got out to the car, and I will never forget it. I know you know what I'm talking about. Just, I heard that, ksh, and everything in me went, oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I heard that, ksh. I'm getting chills now. But really, and that was it. Now, it took me a while, because, see, I learned my lesson. So I was going to smoke the weed. I wasn't going to drink and drive. By this time, I lived closer to the city, so I could walk to the different bars. And it was going to be different. It was going to be different. I had it all under control. The day I came in, 9 months later, 9/27 or 26, 9 months later to the day, I couldn't find any weed. There was some kind of drought all over the country. There really was. All up and down the East Coast. Nobody had weed. My brother-in-law, who used to fly out of the country and fly back with it taped to him, he didn't have any weed. And I was sitting in my apartment. It was a Saturday, and I was nervous, and I was sipping a beer, because by now I knew, you know, what was going to happen, and I didn't want to go down that road. And a friend of mine called and said, let's go over so-and-so's house. He might have some. And we went over there, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and the weed never showed up. And I was antsy, so I went back home. And I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, this is going to be all right. I got this. This will be okay. I'll go home. I'll have one beer. I'll put my jammies on. I'll watch TV. This is no big deal. I got my jammies on. I'm sipping my beer. I'm sitting on the couch, and I said out loud, and this time I heard myself say it. I said, if I don't get some weed, I'm going to get really drunk. I'm afraid. I said it out loud. And in that moment, God moved in. He said, hey, there's an opening. And I went to the phone, and I went to my little Rolodex, and I got the number for the NABA Club that was in my Rolodex from the year before. And I called up, and a woman answered the phone. She gave me directions, and I found it. I found it immediately. I went right there. And I pulled in. It was Saturday night, and they had a meeting called the Saturday Night Frights. And that's Saturday Night Frights. It was like a 10 or 11 o'clock at night meeting. And then everybody went to Denny's afterwards. And I felt, the minute I walked in that room, I knew I was home. But I came in on the first step. I knew I was powerless. I came to that sitting on the couch. If I don't get some weed, I'm going to drink, and I'm not going to be able to stop myself. And I was afraid of drinking, because when I drank, I blacked out. And I didn't want to end up like my grandmother. So there I was at the Saturday Night Frights, and I picked up my white chip. But I came in powerless over alcohol, but I was pretty sure that my life was not unmanageable. I had a job. I had a car. I had my own place. My life's not unmanageable. I just got a drinking problem. So you guys just help me with the drinking part, and I really don't need any help with the rest. And that's how I came in. I came in on step one and the first half of step two. And my life, I immediately got involved in a big book and step meetings. And MABA at that time had meetings going on all the time, and they had really strong sobriety leading step meetings and big book meetings. Now, I was drawn to that because I like data, and I'm a control freak, and I like to figure stuff out. So when they said, here's a book, and here's another book, I was like, yeah, all right, we got this. And I jumped right in to the 12 and 12 and to the big book, and got totally immersed in that to begin with. I drove right to NAM, I said that. And rocked along for about 7 or 8 years. 7 or 8 years. I was 7 or 8 years when I got married. Did a lot of service work in the very beginning. A lot of service work. And one of the things that some of the guys in the 12-step and big book meetings I was going to, somebody handed me a Emmett Fox book. And I was struggling with the third step. And I don't know if you've heard of Emmett Fox, but some of our founders were reading that. He was a preacher and a teacher and a minister back in the day when AA was first being formed. And so a lot of our, and that really was a pivotal, that changed things for me, reading Emmett Fox. But anyway, when I got to the, I was still thinking my life was unmanageable. And we were reading in the 12 and 12. This was why the step meetings were so important for me. The meeting that I was in, the Come to Believe group at Saturday Night NABA Club, we read the steps. We just cycled around. We looped around. We read maybe one or two pages, and then we talked on just that. And it was a great group. And when we got to the second step, there was a description. I think it's the last paragraph in the second step talks about how our insanity, even if our insanity was throwing the dining room furniture. And I went, ah, because I had done that. See, I didn't think I was insane. I just had a drinking problem. My life was manageable. But I read that part about, because I had thrown some dining room chairs at some boyfriends. You know, I had that in my past. And there it was in black and white. Even if our insanity was just throwing the dining room furniture, and I thought, how the hell did they know that? Got me. And I went through a period of time where I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I didn't take the morning drink. And one day I was sitting in a meeting, big meeting, Saturday morning meeting, and my buddy, this is so funny, I can tell you his name, and you'll see why it's so funny. His name is Joe Roach. And Joe was sharing about how he didn't take a morning drink, but he always had a joint every morning. Joe Roach, right? And it was another one of those, damn, they got me again. Because you know, I knew that when I gave up the alcohol, I was giving up the weed too. But I didn't think that the weed counted as a morning drink. But it kind of really sort of did. For me, anyway. I mean, you know, you have to come to all those conclusions on your own. But I was struggling with whether or not I was an alcoholic. And Joe shared in that meeting that as far as he was concerned, that was his morning drink, and boom, I was in. I was relieved because I wanted this to work for me because I had nowhere else to go. So I struggled with that question. I'm typical textbook alcoholic. I struggle with everything they talk about and describe in the big book. Went through the phases of denial. Well, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. I just have a problem drinking and blah, blah, blah. But it didn't matter. I liked being here because this is the first time I felt safe when I was here. So it was a good thing I got to stay, right? Yeah. So I, about 7 or 8 years into sobriety, as far as the steps go, I struggled with 3. And once I got past 3, 4 just kind of fell into place. And 4, Bobby Meadows, it's amazing how many people are gone that helped me, used to say that you can't cheat the process. So if you're in this process and you're giving it some effort, this process is going to work. Now, if you give it this much effort, it's going to work this much. If you give it this much, it's going to work this much. If you give it this much, it's going to work this much. Any little bit you're doing on the fourth step is going to make a difference. And what I also, another thing Bobby used to say was that this is your sobriety. It's not anybody else's. You're doing, this is your fourth step. So we all have different, you'll hear a lot of people talk in meetings about, well, you got to do this, or you got to do that, or the 11th step comes here, and this, no, it doesn't matter. Just don't drink, get involved in that process, which is about spiritual unfolding, because that is the answer the literature tells us. The answer is spiritual awakening. That's the process I need to be involved in on a regular basis to be relieved of the alcoholism. And literature tells me that the answer lies in still more spiritual growth. So if you're feeling stagnant or you're feeling like something ain't working, start branching out. Try to find other ways to read other things. It says it in our big book. You know, avail yourself of other clergy and other what other writers have to offer. Because that's where the answer is, for me anyway. So anyway, about 7 or 8 years, I got married to another alcoholic who was a few years behind me. I was Miss AA then. And he was a few years behind me. And turns out he was really spiritual. And we were married for 7 years and had a son. And then he passed after 7 years of marriage. So we married in 92 and he passed in 99. And I remember thinking, I had a bunch of people that surrounded me, AA people, and I remember thinking, I didn't want to drink. I just wanted to die. And I didn't want to die. I didn't want to hurt myself kind of die. I just wanted to stop breathing. Does anybody know that feeling? I don't want to do anything. I just want to stop breathing. And I'm here to tell you, I got through that without drinking. And I look back on it today, and I think, wow, that's amazing. And my son was 5 at the time, and I used to tell people, well, if it weren't for Cody. So now Cody's 20, and Cody left the house. And once he left the house, I had a lot of residual stuff, Julie and I were talking about, that came up. And I realized that it's stuff that I put on hold because when he was 5, if it weren't for Cody, and now Cody's gone. But even in this, I was talking about walking at the lake, I had a really bad spell in November, December of last year. extremely depressed. Didn't want to drink. I wanted to die, though. I wanted to stop breathing. I was sitting on the dock right out here, and I was thinking about how I might end it. And I thought, well, you know, a gun, that would hurt. A knife would hurt. Hanging yourself, that's a lot of effort. I mean, you got to find a room. I mean, that's just too much to figure out. And I thought, well, maybe I can just, I'm a very good swimmer and I love the water, so I can't just jump in the lake. You know, I mean, I would just automatically swim. So I was sitting there and I thought, well, I'll just hold my breath. I said, well, then I would fall on the deck and it would bump my head, it would wake me up and I'd start breathing. So I came this close to smoking again. But I didn't want to quit. I wanted to be a sometime smoker. But the point of me telling you this is that I got through that. But I didn't get through that on my own. I got through that through the help of a higher power, God as I understand God. And that was the thing that was so key to me being where I am right now today. Because I thought that I was not worthy of God. While I was drinking, I know that sounds real trite, right? You hear that a lot of meetings. But I really did. I thought everybody else had a gene or they had a chemical ingredient in their bodies that connected them with God, and for some reason I didn't have it. And I felt that way about myself, pretty much about everything. And I used to go into different churches when I was drinking, and I used to sit in them, and I used to try to get the God thing on. You know, I don't know how to describe it. And I couldn't get it. Well, I found out now that I was in maybe not the right kind of churches. But anyway, that's another story. But for me, not the right kind of churches for me. Or maybe it's because I was drunk and hungover.
Right.
Yeah, maybe that was it. So, but I was always looking for God. And when I read the big book and they gave me permission to pray, I didn't know that I could. I thought that that was something that was reserved for good people who went to church and kept it together. I didn't think that that was a privilege that I could partake of. So when I got here and they told me I could pray, not only could I pray, but I probably should start right away. I jumped on it. I really did. And I started with the please and the thank you. And she were talking about the grapevines. People were handing me grapevines. Great to read when I was first coming in, because they were real simple stories and I could absorb some of it. And then there was another book we had, Susie, How to Live Sober.
Living Sober.
Oh, love that book. I went through a period of time where I was giving that out to every white chick, because that book saved my ass. Because I couldn't figure out. Now, let me tell you something. I didn't drink during the week, but on the weekends, I drank 24/7. I probably drank more during the week than I'm willing to admit, or that I remember. But I couldn't do anything around the house, like clean the house or go grocery. I always had to have a little buzz on. And I remember when I first got sober, I thought, well, shoot, how am I going to do laundry? Because the laundry room was in the downstairs of the apartment, and it was, you know, get a little beer, go down and do the laundry. Well, how am I going to do the laundry now, I thought. And, you know, somebody gave me the Living Sober book, and then my friend Kay came over and did laundry with me for the first month or so. She showed, because I shared in a meeting that, you know, weekends were going to be hard. And she came over on Saturday mornings, knocked on my door. Hey, how you doing? And whether I wanted her to or not. And I was really fortunate getting sober, because I got sober in the DeKalb County, and Napa was there, and the Biscayne was there. And I wasn't that far from Triangle, because I lived right on Lindbergh Drive. So I had all these clubhouses that had meetings around the clock. And I was working, and I was single at the time and didn't have any kids. So I could go as often as I wanted. And I worked right down the street from NAMA off of the Northeast Expressway. And I got up in the morning. I went to work. I went to NAMA, went to a 5 o'clock meeting. Went out and got dinner, came back and went to an 8 o'clock meeting, and then went with people over to Triangle for their 10 o'clock meeting, and then went home, went to bed. I didn't go home for the first couple of years until I was dead tired, because they say change your playgrounds. My home was my playground. When I first got sober, I was just drinking at home alone. So that was my playground, and I thought I wasn't hanging in bars anymore. If I was hanging in bars, I don't remember it. But home was where I was drinking, and I was drinking alone. So I changed that playground. And very soon after I got sober, I moved. So I had a whole new sober apartment right around the corner from NAMA. I've experienced all kinds of loss in sobriety, which anybody who's been sober for a while can tell you. Anybody who's been alive for a while. And I remember there's a one part, I can't remember if it's in the big book in the 12 and 12, that talks about how we forget. We think that, oh, money troubles and all that, it only happens to us, oh, poor us. No, it happens to everybody out there. And some people actually manage to get through it without even thinking about a drink. Some people actually go their whole lives dealing with stuff, never drinking. And as an alcoholic, I always got into the, you know, these were such a big deal, but it's not a big deal. And part of what's been really good about being sober is building new relationships and connecting with people in the real world. Big Book tells me I need to get out into the mainstream of life. That doesn't mean preaching, although I went through that phase, to people about, you know, sobriety and everything, but just being an ear for somebody and listening to them and realizing that everybody's got money troubles. I've had two bankruptcies in sobriety. I've had more money troubles in sobriety than I had before because I was in control before and I had certain criteria. And the money troubles have actually helped me to grow spiritually. I wouldn't recommend it. I'm not saying go out there and get yourself into debt, but, you know, there's any situation that I get myself into, there's a lesson in there. And I will just close with this. I don't know if it's time for me to close, because I could go on and on and on. But I want to tell you something. I've been running in a lot of different spiritual circles since Alcoholics Anonymous. Many different churches and teachings and readings, and they've all been phenomenal. I have a regular meditation practice. It took me 20 years to get that going. And I'm here to tell you, we got a leg up in here. Because I was sharing with a spiritual teacher at one of the churches that I go to about self-examination and self-awareness. And I was telling her about how in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to do it. Well, let me tell you something, folks. There are people out there they're not doing that. And we're doing it because it's life or death. Now, I didn't think I was going to die. What I thought was going to happen if I couldn't get through this was that I would have no place else to go. Although I didn't associate that with death at the time, that was my big thing. I was afraid that if I failed here, that I would have to leave. And I had failed at so many things. And I remember one time speaking at a birthday meeting and saying, I love it because this is the one thing I have done completely, one day at a time, is to be here and stay sober. And I have a long history of starts and stops, false starts, and, you know, all kinds of big ideas and never following through. And I still have a lot of those. But that's okay. But this is the one thing that I've done, and we really do have a leg up here. With that self-examination, that's where the spirituality for me is coming in. I don't know if it's in the 12-12 or the big book. Self-examination, meditation, and prayer, when taken together, powerful components for rocketing us into another dimension spiritually. And as far as I know, you know, and we do it because we have to. We say the life preservers. We cling to it like the drowning do, and we have a leg up. And I've talked to a number of people in different spiritual modalities that are spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to get it. Right, Susie? And we got a leg up. You got a leg up in here. You really do. So I guess I would close with this. If you're here and you picked up a white chip, it's not by mistake. And we were talking about the things we do for ourselves. And you may not be there right now to where you want to do something for yourself. But you didn't show up by mistake. So just go with it anyway. And as Bobby Meadows used to say, if it doesn't work for you, we'll give you your money back. You know, and you can go back out. But avail yourself of the 12 steps. Because that is not what I bargained for. I didn't come here to get God. I just came here to get the drinking under control, and then I was going to move on with my life. I knew God was a component here, but I didn't realize that it was the whole ball of wax. And I didn't realize that it was exactly what I've been looking for my whole life when I was sitting in those churches with hangovers, trying to make that connection and didn't think I could. I didn't realize that this is what I was looking for. So thank you, everybody.